I thought I'd just try to describe a little bit the nature of the research that I've been engaged in now for nearly 20 years. And I don't quite know how to say this in the right way, but you know, at some point I'm going to die. And when they then intercept me before I go in to heaven, they're going to interview me to see whether I fit or not, you know. And when they sit me down to interview me, I'm going to say, look, I know you got a lot of questions about me, but I got a few questions about you. And if you wouldn't mind, I'm going to go first. And the first one is, just for my own curiosity, how come you didn't finish Wyoming? And seriously, if you ever drive on Interstate 80 and you go past Rock Springs in the center-south part, it's clear that they ran out of time. And I just want to understand why. But then after that, I have some serious questions. And the next one is, dang it, you oriented us when you stuck us on Earth to face the future, but you only made data available about the past. And why did you do this to us? Because for better or for worse, I spent much of my life teaching at the Harvard Business School, and we taught our students that they should be data-driven and analytical and fact-based in their decisions. But because we taught them to make decisions in that way, in essence, what we taught them is to make action when the game is over. And it is really a problem in the way that we teach, because data, in fact, is only available about the past. And I think that I know the answer that they're going to give me on that one. And that is, yeah, we didn't make data about the future, but we gave theories to mankind. And a good theory is a statement of causality. And because if you have a good theory, you can see what's happening. You can then predict what the result will be in the future, even if you don't have data about that. And when I've made this assertion that what I'm trying to do is develop good theories, often people will come back to me and say, look, Clay, if you look outside the physical world, is very well structured, and so you can understand theories about the physical world. But business organizations are so messy that there just isn't any way you could develop theories about business and economics. And my response to that is, 400 years ago, if you looked outside, holy cow, the world looked very unpredictable, capricious. Stuff happened and you didn't understand why. And you gave very lame explanations for why things happen in the way they do. But thank goodness, over the last 400 years, scientists, using the scientific method, little by little have developed theories that explain what causes things to happen in our world and why. And so when we look outside, it appears as if the physical world is very orderly and predictable, and we can explain what things happen and why. And yet we think that inside of businesses, it's unpredictable. And it may be that you just can't put your arms around it, but what I'm hoping that I can bring is a deep feeling that theory can be developed that allows us in business to bring order and predictability to what historically has seemed like something that is just unfathomable. And so what I want to do is just describe a couple of theories that have emerged from my work, and then try to apply them to a couple of problems. And we'll see if how whether you fall asleep or not, then I'll stop. But the first one is, you know, if you summed up the balance sheets and income statements of the S&P 500, it appears as if our economy is growing smartly, but we're not creating jobs. And it just doesn't feel right to me. For the first six recessions after World War II, when the economy hit bottom, within about 6 months on average, they had rebounded and the economy was going at roughly the level of the prior peak. But in the recession around 1991, it took us 15 months to get out of the recession. In the 2001-02 recession, it took us 39 months to get out of the recession. And now we've been at it for nearly 65 months, and we still haven't gotten back to the prior peak. So there just is something fundamental that has gone wrong with our economy, I think. And so what I want to describe is a theory called disruption that I think has helped me, combined with some things that finance have done to the world. So I'll put on the vertical axis the performance of a product or service over time. And I'm going to describe three types of innovations that are salient for this issue about our economy. So in every market, there is a trajectory of improvement that customers are able to utilize. Now, there's always a distribution. So at the high end of every market, there are very demanding customers who have very complicated problems, and they will never be satisfied with the best that you can give them. And at the bottom of every market, there are simple people who have simple problems, and you can overshoot what they can use with very little. But that's the first element of this model of disruption, is that in every market, there's an ability to utilize improvement. Now, the second element is in every market, there's a different trajectory of technological improvement that innovating companies provide as they keep introducing better and better products. The most important finding about this is this trajectory of technological progress almost always outstrips the ability of customers to use the progress. And so a technology that's not good enough for what mainstream customers need at one point are prone to overshoot what they can use at a later point in time. And those of you who have a bit of gray hair, remember that in the mid-1980s, when we were first learning how to use those early personal computers for word processing, about every 30 seconds you had to stop and let the Intel 286 chip inside the computer catch up with you. Because the world's fastest processor wasn't even fast enough to keep pace with our fingers. But as Intel introduced faster and faster chips, a few years ago they introduced the first 3 gigahertz Pentium 4 processor, they had shot way beyond what most people in mainstream applications can use. Now, some of the innovations that help companies move up that trajectory are just incremental year-to-year improvements that every good company can grind out. Others of them, though, are dramatic breakthrough improvements. So in the telecoms industry, the transition from analog to digital and digital to optical signaling cost tens of billions of dollars to develop and deploy. But it turns out, for this purpose, that what these guys are trying to do are the same thing that what these people are trying to do, and that is they're trying to make better products that they could sell for better profits to their best customers. And it turns out that the companies that are the leaders in an industry here, before these battles of what I call sustaining innovations begin, find themselves still on top of the industry when the battles are over. And it just doesn't matter technologically how difficult it is. If the purpose of the innovation is to make a better product that you could sell for better profits to your best customers, they almost always end up on top. And so if you're wondering about, should I start a new company? This little piece of the model says, it depends. Because if you think you can make a better product that you can sell for better profits to their best customers, they'll kill you. But that's one type of innovation. Now, there's another type of innovation that I call a disruptive innovation. And I need to set the context here. So I've got three concentric kind of circles, and they represent people who have a lot of money in the middle, and then as you move to larger populations of people out here, you run up with customers who don't have much. Almost always, new industries start in the middle because the first manifestations of the new technology are complicated and expensive. And so only the people with a lot of money and a lot of skill have access to that. But then there is a type of innovation that transforms this complicated, expensive product into something that is so much more affordable and accessible that a much larger population of people have access to it. And in various things I've written, I call these disruptive. Another word might be empowering innovations, meaning that they transform complicated, expensive junk into something that enables or empowers many more people to have access to it. And so examples of this in our history is Henry Ford with the Model T transformed a car and made it so affordable and accessible that lots of people could have one. The personal computer was one of these. When the first computers manifest themselves, they were called mainframe computers. They cost about $2 million. You had to take years of training to operate them. And so only the largest universities and the largest corporations could have one. But then the personal computer made it affordable and accessible, so a much larger population have access to it. And what we found is that these almost always an entrant company comes in and kills the leaders in the middle. So in other words, the type of innovation that we call sustaining innovations, the leaders always win developing better products. But when this emerges, these guys can't do it because it makes no sense for them to do it. And so what I'd like to do is describe how these kind of things happen in two industries. And I want to stay in the first one with the personal computer. There was a company in the Boston area through the 1960s, 70s, and 80s called Digital Equipment Corporation. And if you're older, you remember these guys. But during that era, digital equipment was probably the most widely admired of all of the companies in the world. And when you read explanations about why digital was so successful, always it was attributed to the brilliance of the management team. And then about 1988, digital equipment just fell off the cliff and began unraveling very quickly. When you then read explanations about why digital had stumbled so badly, it was always attributed to the ineptitude of the management team. It's the same folks running the company. So something happened. And the way I framed it is, geez, I wonder how smart people could get stupid so fast. And almost always when a successful company stumbles, we attribute it to the ineptitude in some way of managers who at one point were right at the top of their game, and then they found themselves out of their league. But in this case, the reason the stupid manager hypothesis just didn't make sense is that they made a class of computers that we called mini computers. And we called them mini because they were much smaller than mainframes, but they were the size of this podium. And every one of the companies that made mini computers collapsed in unison. It wasn't just Digital Equipment, but Data General, Prime, Wang, Nixdorf, Hewlett-Packard, Honeywell. And you could expect these companies to compete, to collude on price. But to collude to collapse was just a stretch. And there just had to be something going on. Anyway, this is the explanation for why the guys in the middle can't do it. So Digital Equipment, making these mini computers, they sold for about $250,000. And they were complicated. That meant that they had to be sold direct from the company to the customer. And the selling process involved a lot of training, support, service, and software. And you just had to have that business, that those costs in the business to play in the game. So these guys had to generate gross margins of about 45%. And that's the way, that's how they made money. Now, through the 1980s, there were people coming into senior management every day with proposals to make new products for Digital Equipment. Some of these entailed making better and bigger computers than they had ever made before. If you looked at those business plans, you could sell those things for $500,000 and you could earn gross margins of 60%. Now, while the management was trying to decide if they should invest to make bigger and better computers, there were other people coming in through the 80s saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, just look out the window. Everybody's buying personal computers. Can't you see it?" And so they'd go over and look outside, and indeed they could see that everybody was buying personal computers. But when they looked hard, they could see a couple of troubling things. The first one is, again, those of you who are a little bit older, do you remember how crummy those early personal computers were? In fact, Apple sold the Apple II as a toy to children. Not a single one of Digital's computers could even use a personal computer for the first 10 years that they were in the market, and that meant because it wasn't good enough for what they needed. And therefore, the more carefully they listened to their customers, they got no signal from their customers that the personal computer mattered, because in fact it didn't. And then when Digital looked at the business plans, it just looked worse, because in the best years, they could generate gross margins of 40%. They headed to 20% quickly, and you could only earn those paltry percentages on computers that sold for $2,000. And so the management had to make a choice. "Guys, I wonder if we should use our capital to make better products that we could sell for better profits to our best customers. Alternatively, maybe we ought to use the capital to make worse products that none of our customers would buy that would wreck our margins. I wonder what we should do." And it turns out that the principles of good management that are taught at Darden and HBS, that is, you should always listen to your customers, and you should always focus investments where the margins are most attractive. Those principles provide very good guidance to companies as they move up that sustaining trajectory. But when the issue is, can we make it affordable and accessible so lots more people have access to it, those principles of good management makes it almost impossible for these people to make them affordable and accessible. So where I've taken you, I'm sorry, is this is one type of innovation, this is another type of innovation, and I'm gonna introduce a third type, and then I'm gonna try to put them together in a crude model about that begins to explain, I think, why our economy is stuck. So this third type of innovation, I'll call efficiency innovations. And this is an innovation primarily a process type of innovation that allows you to sell the same product to the same customers at lower prices. And so Walmart is an efficiency innovation. You can deliver the stuff at about 20% lower cost than Macy's can deliver the same stuff. But I want to describe it in the context of the steel industry, because it is a good example or a causal mechanism why smart people can't do smart things. So just looking at you, I don't think a lot of you have yet made a lot of steel. Historically, most of the world's steel was made in massive integrated steel companies. It costs today about $10 billion U.S. dollars to build an integrated mill. The other way to do it is in what we call a mini mill. And a mini mill melts scrap in electric furnaces. And you could probably put 12 electric furnaces in this room. Because you can get molten steel in a small chamber like this, you don't have to scale up the downstream steps. And that's why we call these things mini mills. The most important dimension of a mini mill is they melt scrap in these furnaces. You can make steel of any given quality in a mini mill for 20% lower cost than you can make it in an integrated mill. So think about this for a minute. Just imagine that you were the CEO of an integrated steel company somewhere in the world. Here is a new technology, the mini mill, that would allow you to reduce the cost of making that steel by 20%. And this is a tough commodity business. Don't you think you'd adopt this new technology? And yet not a single integrated steel company anywhere in the world has yet successfully built and operated a mini mill. A few in the last couple of years had belatedly acquired one, but nobody's been able to build one from scratch. And this is my sense for why something that makes consummate sense is impossible for smart people to do. In other words, smart people struggle at efficiency innovations. So the steel market, like all market, is tiered. So at the bottom, concrete reinforcing bar or rebar, almost all of us could make rebar if we wanted to. At the high end of the market is sheet steel that is used to make appliances and cars. It is very hard to make. And at the beginning of this story, the integrated steel companies made the full range of the products. The mini mills became technologically viable in the mid-1960s. And because they were melting scrap in these electric furnaces, the quality that they could produce was uniformly bad and very variable. And in fact, the only market that would buy what the mini mills made was the rebar market at the bottom, because there are almost no specifications for rebar anyway, and then once you buried it in cement, you couldn't verify whether it met spec or not. And so rebar was a perfect market for crummy products. As the mini mills attacked that tier of the market, the reaction to integrated mills was, man, they were happy to get out of the rebar business because it truly was a dog-eat-dog commodity. They could only generate gross margins of 7%. And it made no sense for them to defend a 7% business where up in angle iron and bar and rod, they could generate gross margins of 12%. So as these guys expanded their capacity, these guys got out of the business, and then an interesting thing happened. When the integrated mills lopped off rebar and added up the remaining numbers, their gross margins improved when they got out. These guys, because they had a 20% cost advantage, their gross margins were beautiful as they got in. And they were quite happy, one with another. One to get out, the other to get in, until 1979. And that was the year when the mini mills finally succeeded in driving the last high-cost integrated player out of the rebar market. If you look at what happened to the price of rebar in 1979, the price collapsed by 20%. And it just turns out that there's a subtle fact about strategy that nobody had thought about before, and that is a low-cost strategy only works as long as you have a high-cost competitor in your market. And as soon as they had fled up market, then it was just low-cost mini-mill fighting against low-cost mini-mill in a commodity business, and very quickly competition drove prices down to the point where none of the mini mills could make money. So what are these poor suckers gonna do? Well, they try to become more efficient making rebar, but that's just a recipe for survival. And then one of them looked up market and said, ladies and gentlemen, look at this. If we could just make bigger and better steel, we'd make money again, because the margins are nearly double what we're making down here. And so they stretched their ability from making this to making those products. The reaction of the integrated mills was, man, they were happy to get out of that business, because it was such a dog-eat-dog commodity. And why would they ever want to defend a crummy 12% margin business where in structural steel they could make 18% margins? And so as these guys expanded their capacity, these guys got out of it. And as they lopped off the lowest profit part of their product line and added up the remaining numbers, their profitability improved when they got out. And as these got in, they had a 20% cost advantage again. So they really liked each other. And that was the case until 1984. That was the year when the mini mills finally succeeded in driving the last high-cost integrated player out of angle iron, bar, and rod. If you look at what happened to the prices of those products in that year, the price collapsed by 20%. And the reward to the mini mills for their victory is they couldn't make any money. So what are those poor suckers gonna do? They just have to go up market. And as they changed this into the smallest structural steel markets, the kind that undergird mobile homes and things like that, they hit the low end of that market. The reaction at integrated mills was, man, they were happy to get out of that business, because it was such a dog-eat-dog commodity. And I don't know if I told you this story before, but the very same thing happened. These guys got out because in sheet steel, they could make these kind of margins, and it made no sense to defend this when you had that as an option. As they got out, profitability improved. As these guys got in, profitability improved. Things were fine until 96, and the price of structural steel collapsed by 20%. And the reward again was no money. So what's Nucor going to do? They just got to do that. And at the beginning, as they hit the commodity sheet, the reaction of the integrated mills was, we're going to specialty steels, because the margins up there are 40%. And so now in America, 65% of America's steel is made in mini mills, and all but one of the integrated mills has gone bankrupt. And you notice that I was able to tell this whole story without using the words stupid manager once. Because everybody did what good managers do. These guys focus their investments where profitability is most attractive. These guys do the same thing. But it's kind of like if you were a little boy and you want to kill a giant. What does the theory say you ought to do? Well, if you try to make better products that you could sell for better profits to the giant's best customers, they'll kill you. But if you come down here and pick a fight where the giant is actually motivated in the pursuit of profit to flee rather than fight you, that's the way, it's a reason why success is so hard to sustain. And we could spend a couple of days talking about how this has happened in industry after industry. I'll just give one and then I'll try to put it all together. Any of you hear of a company called Toyota? Do you remember how they came into the U.S. market? Not with Lexuses, but in the mid-1960s, they came in with a rusty little subcompact that was called a Corona. And it was so cheap that they could sell it to the rebar of humanity, people that we call college students. And then they went from a Corona to Tercel, Corolla, Camry, Avalon, Forerunner, Sequoia, and then a Lexus. And as Toyota's coming up from the bottom, General Motors and Ford were up here making big cars for big people. And they'd look at Toyota coming down and say, you know, we ought to just go get those buggers. And they designed subcompacts that were called Pintos and Chevettes. Do you remember those? But they would then compare the profitability of a crummy subcompact business with the profitability of making even bigger SUVs and even bigger pickup trucks to even bigger people. It just made no sense. And now, essentially, Detroit has been disrupted out of the world. And here's Toyota. Who's killing Toyota? They don't feel as if they're being killed, incidentally. The Koreans, Hyundai and Kia, have stolen the bottom of the market from Toyota. And it's not because Toyota's asleep at the switch. But why would they ever want to defend a crummy low-end marginal business when they have the privilege of competing against Mercedes in luxury cars? And then Chery comes from China next. And thank goodness we don't have to worry about that at all. So this is the third type of innovation. So we have sustaining, disruptive, or empowering innovations, and efficiency innovations. And now I'm going to try to put them together in a way that I hadn't thought about before. So I'll put the empowering or disruptive innovations over here. And again, these are kind of innovations that transform costly, expensive things into things that are affordable and accessible. Those kinds of innovations create jobs. It's by making them affordable and accessible, many more people buy the stuff. Therefore, you have to hire people to make it, sell it, distribute it, service it, and so on. The data doesn't exist, but if it existed, I bet that these kinds of innovations account for somewhere around 100% of all of the net jobs created in America in the last century. Then the second type, we talked about sustaining innovations, and they account for most of the innovations in our society, but they have a neutral effect on jobs and capital. And the reason why is when you make better products that you could sell for better profits to your best customers, whenever they buy one of those, they don't buy what they bought last time. So Toyota has a marvelous innovation called the Prius. Every time they sell a Prius, they don't sell a Camry. So by its very nature, it replaces old products with new products. And as a consequence, our sense is that they don't create a lot of new jobs. And they're very important because they keep the economy vibrant. These guys use a lot of capital because you're expanding your capacity to make more stuff. But again, here, because it's replaceative, they don't use a lot of capital either. And then we decided that the third type were efficiency innovations that essentially allows you to make the same thing cheaper. And we decided that those guys eliminate jobs just by its very nature. They're process-related innovations. And to get it to the market, you just have to do more with less. And so Walmart is one of those. When they move into a community, Walmart hires a lot of people, but people who are surround them, who run small shops, lose their jobs. And on aggregate, they eliminate jobs. But that's a good thing, because if they don't make things more and more efficient, then somebody abroad will just come and blow out the whole company if we don't make them efficient. But we decided that efficiency jobs create capital. And capital is actually important because it's like the fuel that the economy needs to burn in order to grow. And what I mean by that is, before Toyota's production system, it took General Motors about 60 days to manage the building of a car in a plant. And that meant you had 60 days of work in process inventory, and it took a lot of capital to support process. I had a stroke a couple of years ago, and sometimes I can't come to the words. You need capital for work in process inventory. When Toyota came up with their production system, they figured out how to make the car in 2 days rather than 60. And so all of that work in process inventory was obviated, and essentially capital had been imprisoned in the balance sheet, and now it becomes emancipated through these kinds of efficiency innovations. Macy's turns their inventory over 3 times a year. Walmart does it 6 times a year. And it emancipates capital. And so the nice thing about creating capital is that then you can use that capital to invest in these things. And what a great system. And for, I think, about the last 150 years, except for the last 20, this worked in some kind of a mechanistic way to keep the economy going. But then something happened about 20 years ago, and this is what I think happened. And you'll see that this is a very crude model. So I'd love to visit with you about how to make it better. There's a guy named George Gilder, who's kind of, I don't need to talk about him, but he's a very smart guy. And he offered a paradigm, which was, if something is scarce and costly, you need to husband its use. And not just throw it willy-nilly, but if you're going to put that to use, you want to only put it in applications where it can be leveraged maximally, if it's scarce and costly. On the other hand, if something is cheap and abundant, you don't have to husband its use. You can waste it if you need to. And sand is like one of those. Well, I think that through the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, as what we might call new finance coalesced in our business schools, capital was very costly and very scarce. And so a whole field of finance emerged to help managers husband the use of capital and only deploy it in applications where a dollar invested supports the most revenue and profitability as possible. And prior to this, my sense is that managers, when they needed to measure profitability, they used crude measures like tons of cash. And thank goodness finance came to the rescue to be more sophisticated about, are we using our capital in the most productive way. And so they gave us ratios instead of crude measures. And so they gave us return on capital employed. And that's a ratio. And the nice thing about a ratio is you got options. So we could get the ratio up by innovating that we can sell for profitable products. Or what the heck, we could outsource things and get assets off the balance sheet by acting on the denominator. But either way, return on capital employed goes up. And so, because capital was scarce, that was taught as the gospel. And everybody at HBS and here and Wharton accepted the gospel and were baptized in this. This is how we need to measure things. Or there is another ratio called internal rate of return. And the great thing about that is it's a ratio. And sure, you could make more profitable products and add that to the numerator, but time is in the calculation. And if you only invest in things that pay off fast, internal rate of return goes up. And so it turns out that measuring profitability in these sophisticated ways, I think over the last 20 years, has had a massive impact on our economy. So you're here and you've got capital and you look at, I wonder if we should invest in disruptive, empowering innovations. Yeah, we could do that, but it pays off over 5 to 8 years. And what's worse is it uses capital. And so return on net assets will go down. On the other hand, if we take our capital and invest in efficiency innovations, there's not as much risk because the market exists and it pays off fast and it creates capital. And the great thing about creating capital is you can invest more capital. And so they invest in this stuff because by the way we have taught to measure return on net assets and internal rate of return, this is so much better than that. And then you get more capital, and you say, gee, should we do this additional capital to do that or do this? And this makes more sense, and this makes more sense, and more sense. And so we're in a situation, I think, that over the last 20 years, there have been many, many fewer empowering or disruptive innovations in our economy than emerged in the prior 50 years. Because it makes no sense to invest in things that create jobs. And because we invest in these things, our economy is just awash in capital. We are truly awash in capital. When you talk to private equity partners, what they bemoan is they have so much capital and so few deals. And Bernanke is like he's standing on the beach with a fire hose open full bore, trying to fill up the ocean with capital. And the cost of capital is almost zero. And yet, because we continue to measure profitability by these measures, it makes no sense to do that. And so our economy is where it is. And let me just say one other thing and then get you to throw questions or cannonballs at me. Japan went through this. So if you go back into the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, Japan's economy was growing like no economy had ever grown before. And what were the engines of Japan's growth was Honda, And do you remember they disrupted the motorcycle business by bringing to America what we call the Cub, which was really a bicycle with a motor on it, and it enabled grandmas to have a motorcycle. And then Toyota did it, enabling students to have cars. Do you remember what Sony did? Sony made radio so cheap that even my brother and I could have a radio. We stuck it right here, $2. And then they made televisions portable. And they made printers so cheap that you didn't have to take the copies to the Xerox machine or the copy center, but everybody could have a printer in their office. And these empowering or sustaining or disruptive innovations that emerged from Japan made billions of people around the world have access to things that previously were not possible. And as a consequence, if you were alive, they needed you. And they just hired jobs by the millions in Japan. And then about 1990, Japan's managers and analysts started to measure profitability by these ratios. And if you looked what happened in Japan's economy over the last 25 years, it's just flatlined. There's been no growth. The cost of capital is roughly zero. And they keep investing in efficiency innovations. My sense, I think this is accurate, that the only sustaining or disruptive or empowering innovation that has emerged from Japan in the last 20 years has been the Wii from Nintendo. Seriously. It's the only thing that they've done. And rather than their economy going around in a circle like this, like a perpetual motion machine, they've just laid it out in a straight line. You do this, you do that, you do that. And in a linear way, there's a beginning and there's an end. And that, I hate to say that for Japan, but they're at the end of this sequence. But the scary thing is that America is embarking on that very same sequence. And it isn't anybody's fault, but it raises some interesting questions to me. And so I don't want to put the blame on finance professors, because I've taught that junk too, you know. And so I'm a part of the deal. But when we look at an investment, what we're taught is we have to look at our weighted cost of capital. And if the investment offers more than our weighted cost of capital, we ought to consider that. What happens if the cost of capital is zero? Seriously. And we are taught in business school to calculate net present value, which is you got this money coming out every year into the future, and then you discount that by picking out the cost of capital and dividing the money by that ratio, bring it back to the present. How does that work if the cost of capital is zero? Seriously. It's an interesting question, isn't it? And from George Gilder's point of view, if something is scarce, then you need to husband its use because it's costly and only deploy it where it yields the maximum leverage. But Abu Dhabi and their sovereign fund, they have $1 trillion. Seriously, $1 trillion. What would you do with $1 trillion? And it's just them. And so I think that maybe So this is Clay's sense for why our economy can't get going, is we're stuck here because it makes no sense to do that because the way we've been taught to measure investment. But if in fact now it's so abundant and cheap, maybe we're moving in an era where you can actually waste capital and invest in what's scarce, like, and maybe we don't educate our people well enough that they can get attractive jobs. And maybe that's what we need to measure. Anyway, those are just some thoughts.